Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow is the autumn equinox, which brings to mind the poet William Carlos Williams. Time is a storm in which we are all lost, he wrote. And Groucho Marx, time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a banana. Equinox means equality, and equality is indispensable to American life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I start today's program with a screed I wrote, in which I think qualifies for a disclaimer that it is my opinion, and perhaps only my opinion, in all the united universes. I call it the first freedom. And I start with a quote by James Alexander. Freedom of speech is a principal pillar in a free government. When this support is taken away, the Constitution is dissolved and tyranny is erected on its ruins. He wrote that in 1737. The first newspaper published in England's North American colonies appeared on the streets of Boston on September 25th, 1690. But was soon suppressed because of its unkind remarks about the British crown. 45 years later, in 1735, John Peter Zenger was put on trial and acquitted for defamation against the English king in his newspaper, the New York Weekly Journal, which raised issues of a free press that contributed directly to the First Amendment of the American Constitution. 30 more years passed before Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, which inflamed the American Revolution, and later Rights of Man, which was made the rationale of the French Revolution. 2 years after the Bastille was stormed in France, the Bill of Rights, more as an afterthought tacked onto the American Constitution as its first 10 amendments, were adopted into law as the most basic rights of the common citizenry. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech and a free press in the assumption that liberty survives only in an atmosphere of free and open expression of thought and opinion, no matter how diverse or uncomfortable. And it is the operating bedrock of the rest, greased by the 14th Amendment and its due process clause. Controversy is in fact the language of democracy. Yet those who rule in the name of democracy continually attempt, for their own empowerment, to limit the range of ideas and information necessary to engage in the argument of opinion indispensable to political and personal freedom. The First Amendment has not prevented fervid attempts to impose religious or political orthodoxy in this country. The excessive repression of the McCarthy era ruined the lives and professions of the nation's best writers and thinkers. Christian fundamentalists never stopped trying to ban books from schools and public libraries, and other censorious groups demand control over the contents of school textbooks and the suppression of everything from pornography to Mother Goose. The persistent attempts by government and groups of powerful elites to control public dialogue, particularly in matters of social behavior, has always been dangerous and usually the guise for authoritarian usurpation of the apparatus of communications. Realization of this led directly to the First Amendment, which states clearly and simply that government has no right to interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings, or the right to petition government for redress of grievances. Yet censorship afflicts the nation like a toxic smog. The thought police of the Federal Communications Commission in particular are eternally poised to swoop down upon any radio or television station or broadcaster who dares mention on the air his or her gastrointestinal tract or its functions. And Donald Trump slanders the nation's media as fake news, insisting on his very own news network of not only Trump think, but Trump all the time. Matters of the flesh are regarded as unfit for public consumption except in a caricature form of softcore porn or in commercials for products aimed at bodily dysfunctions. Sex the real thing, and defecation are repressed as filth. The immaturity of a culture can be gauged by the depth of its reluctance to publicly discuss the physiology of its inhabitants. Human beings often seem unwilling to come to terms with their organs and bodily functions. Contradictory values develop. Eating, even to gluttony, is acceptable to public view and product profit. But display of ridding the body of its wastes, generated by stuffing the stomach, is regarded as nasty and vile. Most of the time, most of us past the age of 10 think about sex more than any other subject, aside from food. But we shrink in shame and embarrassment at discussion of sexual organs. Our civic Christianity still persists in the medieval abhorrence of the flesh, its soft, sensuous corruption, the cornerstone of Scripture. Yet we live in an age of science that repudiates ignorance and superstition, even as it replaces them with horror and doubt. Ecology, the interrelationship of life, is tacitly acknowledged. We are aware we are parts of nature and live and die in interdependent relation with other earthly life. We return to Earth the sustenance we consume by jettisoning our waste, which promotes and nourishes other biological growth, which in turn somewhere up the food chain replenishes our sustenance. Our used-up bodies return the loan of life by passing on their protean spark. But we balk. We claim to be descended from gods, not ascended from feces. We wish supremacy, not cooperative empathy. This wrong-headed arrogance has put us at odds with our planet, which we despoil with life-exterminating, non-biodegradable, synthetic plasticity and call it civilization. So we invert our sensibilities and values to cope with an unexpected world we have constructed. A bowel movement in our cultural psyche is regarded as more indecent than an oil spill. Genitals, the organs of pleasure and reproduction, are reviled as unfit for public exposure or discussion. But in contrast, we accept demagogic visions of horror and death, of violence and inhumanity as entertainment. And we seem obsessed with denying our children exposure to things they most want to know and will eventually know on their own. We disregard our own youthful impatience to learn and grow up and inflict identical deceits we endured upon our children. We wish to shield them from unpleasant realities and attempt to forcibly repress their sexuality, yet we expect them to somehow cope. This exaggerated fear of children learning anything about life is a prime palpitation of government and theological censorship. Policing public morality, claiming, of course, that it is only being reflected, is usually an indecently popular and effective method of intruding control over what we read in our newspapers, listen to on our radios and televisions, absorb on the internet and iPhones, and are ultimately persuaded to accept as truth and reality, when in reality our vision is distorted, our perception atrophied, as are our personal values and liberties. This is the real indecency we should worry about. No one should be surprised that a government does not encourage liberty or independent opinion among its subjects. Democracies are only elaborate power balances between ruled and rulers. A most important assumption of a democracy is that the flow of information should not be restricted or tampered with. But, of course, interfering with and manipulating information is among the highest priorities of political power, which accurately assumes the general populace will not give much thought to mind control efforts most of the time. The true purpose of the press, or media, as digital electronics supplants press and paper, is little understood, which is as much the fault of the media itself as it is the result of public unconsciousness. The people expect event and spectacle, which are ardently reported and performed. But the main function of the press, media, is to act as the conscience of authority, the critical watchdog, the cry of alarm when authority is exceeded or corrupt. It is also tasked with presenting differing dialogue and debate. Above all, whatever its various points of view, it must be honest and open with its readers, listeners, viewers, and iPhoners. No argument that the press media can and often does harm people unnecessarily and cruelly. No argument that special interests control ever more strata of the information flow and manipulate its dispersion to project their self-interest. It is probably impossible for the press media to do an adequate job. There is too much to write about, think about, to debate and discuss, and it all moves too quickly, changes too rapidly to pin down well enough. The tendency is to view the chaotic mass through narrow prisms, usually power and economic. Defining journalism is slippery. It is bursting out in a variety of directions from a long, stagnant obsession with the impossible quest for objectivity, always questionable at best, a deceitful masquerade at its worst. Some of these direction-like infotainment and simulated events are unfortunate, and the very thought of the rise of alternate facts is nauseating, especially when it is straight perjury from the very top of American governance. The staunch era of objectivity in reporting humanity's daily turbulence has never been entirely successful. The rules were that personality has to be left out of reporting the facts of events. Human minds, however, are not autonomic. They are colored with imagination and point of view, which is synonymous with angle of reference. The pursuit of objectivity as the cornerstone of journalism was to replace the bad old days of 19th century journalism, which was unsavory with reckless partisanship. The era of just the facts journalism was ushered in as the new form of reformed American journalism. Objectivity in reportage is a fine ideal, but human beings who record events, or, as Gene Fowler said, journalists who shoot history on the wing, are creatures of their cultures, classes, and education, and their attempts at unbiased witness are yet shaped by conscious and or subconscious prejudices and inculcated values. The insidious aspect of objectivity is that inevitably the form is used to disguise very partisan ideas and perspectives, most notably by those who manage and rule society and own the major press media. Here is where alternative realities trample upon credible and reliable avenues of truth. The maxim of despots such as Napoleon, Hitler, and now Trump is that a lie told often enough is asserted as truth. Disagreement with imperiously agreed upon fiction is dismissed as naive or dangerous partisanship, even treachery. Under the Trump regime, anything that contradicts his blustery absolutism is labeled as fake news. Even in the bad old days, the partisan press, for all its renowned excesses, prejudice, and hysteria, the partisan press was in thunderous opposition with itself, while under the rubric of objectivity, today's media cautiously imitates itself, whether in sobriety or slander. The central purpose of modern journalism is to inform, but that is not a passive occupation. The purpose of informing presumes a consequence, an action or reaction regarding the information that is disseminated. The broadest definitions of a reporter, therefore, is anyone who has something to report, regardless of whether they are schooled or employed in journalism. It is obsession with the idea that truth is liberating and that all human beings ought by right of birth be free that keeps the majority of small critical publications and their electronic counterparts struggling on. Small publications that seldom make money are large on seeking answers and truths. Though never quite satisfyingly pure, truth must yet in the real world be free of deceit and distortion. It must be like a rock or a star, a fact defined by its existence. William Allen White wrote in a famous Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper article nearly a century ago, a statement that is peculiarly applicable to current conditions. He said, "You say that freedom of utterance is not for times of stress, and I reply with the sad truth that only in times of stress is freedom of utterance in danger. No one questions it in calm days because it is not needed. And the reverse is also true. Only when free utterance is suppressed is it needed. And when it is most needed, it is most vital to justice. This state is in more danger from suppression than from violence. Violence indeed is the child of suppression." And that was something I wrote, The First Freedom. And now, in response to Donald Trump's imperious and discordant arrogance at the United Nations summit in New York this past Monday, the necessity to restrain his power to wage nuclear war. And that is an article that was written by Jeffrey Botter and Jonathan D. Pollack, "Time to Take Trump's Thumb Off the Nuclear Trigger." For the first time in a generation, there is widespread anxiety about the possibility of nuclear war, stimulated by the extreme tensions between North Korea and the United States. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has advised Americans that they can sleep safely at night, a reassurance that most people probably wish they did not need to hear. Secretary Tillerson offered his soothing counsel to deflate media hype about recent threats exchanged between Pyongyang and Washington. His words also reflect profound unease about the temperament and judgment of the two leaders who could trigger inadvertent war, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. Trump and Kim appear to believe that bombast serves their domestic needs. Both seem to think that they can dominate and intimidate through the direst of threats. However, words can easily have consequences that neither leader seems to grasp. Should we be living in a world where two leaders can stumble into a nuclear holocaust? North Korea's accelerated pursuit of nuclear weapons clearly requires a much enhanced containment and deterrence policy by the United States and its allies to prevent Kim from undertaking ever riskier options. But what can be done to constrain the actions of an American president, whose stability is now openly questioned, even by the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker of Tennessee? To limit the possibilities of an almost unimaginable conflict, there is a need to pursue a long overdue legislative remedy. Under Article 1 of the Constitution, only Congress can declare war. Yet during America's numerous wars since World War II, presidents have never sought such authorization. The major reason? Nuclear weapons. There was widespread agreement that the president needed maximum flexibility to respond to a Soviet attack and that involving Congress would cause undue delays in a moment of crisis. As a result, the president has had essentially unchecked power to wage war, including launching a nuclear strike. However, strategic planners understood the risks of enabling a single officer in a silo in North Dakota, perhaps under the most stressful conditions imaginable, to initiate a nuclear strike. The nuclear command and control system therefore entailed a two-key system requiring simultaneous actions by two officers to activate a launch. The time is long overdue to introduce comparable checks at the highest levels of the executive branch. The strategic circumstances faced by the United States today are altogether different from those during the Cold War. Despite heightened tensions triggered by Russian revanchism in Ukraine and elsewhere in Central and Eastern Europe, the real risk of nuclear war emanates from a rogue actor, and North Korea heads the list. Almost casual presidential invocations of fire and fury have rendered circumstances far more dangerous. The United States should in no way diminish its ability to respond to a nuclear or conventional attack by North Korea against United States territory or the territory of an ally. However, we should put in place a system of constraints to ensure that a preventive or preemptive nuclear strike by the United States must be evaluated through a careful, deliberative process. Congress should therefore amend the War Powers Act to cover possibility of preventive or preemptive nuclear strikes. This would ensure that the president could not simply provide the codes to his military aide carrying the nuclear football and launch such an attack on his own authority. Legislation should provide for a small group of officials, possibly including the vice president, the secretary of defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the four leaders of the House and Senate, to give unanimous consent to any such nuclear strike. It would ensure that multiple sets of eyes, equipped with stable emotions and sound brains, would be able to prevent such a nuclear strike undertaken without appropriate deliberation. This proposal would raise difficult constitutional questions. All presidential administrations have deemed the War Powers Act unconstitutional. Giving officers appointed by the president and subject to his direction formal veto power over military decisions could be problematic and precedent-setting. If so, confining the veto power to the congressional leadership might be a preferable alternative. Even during the Cold War, there was a great risk in ceding to one person the ability to kill millions in a flash. There is no good reason to enable an American president to retain absolute authority in circumstances completely unlike those faced during the Cold War. Assurances that nuclear weapons remain an option of absolute last resort, to be considered only after the concurrence of leaders from the executive branch and from the Congress, would also calm the nerves of United States allies deeply troubled by loose talk about the resort to nuclear weapons. This is not to suggest that President Trump nurses some secret desire to launch a nuclear attack. However, the United States needs to act very prudently in dealing with an isolated and uniquely adversarial state. For its part, Congress has the power to prevent hair trigger responses or impulsive actions that could lead to nuclear war. And that was Time to Take Trump's Thumb Off the Nuclear Trigger by Jeffrey Botter and Jonathan D. Pollack. Jeffrey Botter and Jonathan Pollack wrote this article for the New York Times. Both are senior fellows at the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Botter served in the Obama administration and is author of Obama and China's Rise, an Insider's Account of America's Asia Strategy. Pollack was chairman of the Strategic Research Department in the U.S. Naval War College prior to joining the Brookings Institute. His latest of more than two dozen books he has authored or edited is soon to be published as Endangered Order, Revisionism and Strategic Risk in Northeast Asia. And I'd like to present a quote of the week. No, not Donald Trump's threat at the United Nations summit Monday to destroy North Korea, or his intent to violate the nuclear treaty with Iran, nor his bellicose warning of imposing regime change and banana oil war in Venezuela. This quote is from an Oregon gun dealer lamenting the decline in gun sales since the election of Trump. Bruce Polvey of Lincoln City Sporting Goods told the Newport News Times about the paradoxical Trump slump. He said, "Everybody thought Hillary Clinton would win the presidency and try to push through a lot of new gun controls. So gun makers ramped up manufacturing and the dealers stocked up. Now there's a huge surplus of firearms and the prices have crashed. Statewide applications are down 30%. At least 12 gun stores I know of between Vancouver, Washington, and Eugene have gone out of business recently. It's a perverse dynamic of the gun market that politicians who want to ban guns are good for business, but Donald Trump, who opposes gun control, couldn't sell a squirt gun. And that was something Bruce Poldy said this past week for the Newport News Times. And this has been Michael McCusker. My gratitude to everyone who responded to the Fall Pledge Drive overall, and to this program especially. You have kept me on the air once again. Earthquakes in Mexico, more killer hurricanes in the Caribbean. Sympathy for the victims will eventually revert to empathy when the great Cascadia earthquake and tsunami strike the Pacific coast. So prepare. And don't be surprised if Trump's threat to destroy North Korea provides intensified inspiration for his poltergeist to nuke our Pacific shores.